Welcome, everybody. It's so wonderful to see you all here to think a little bit and reflect on Talmud this evening. I want to offer some thoughts why Talmud is the bedrock of my faith and really paint a picture of finding a theology of inquiry and attentiveness, through love of Talmud. So when I was 12 years old, I learned my first page of Gemara. I started learning Talmud in the sixth grade with Rabbi Eisenman, Rabbi David Eisenman, in the pioneering class at one of very few schools in Baltimore, very few schools in North America, very few schools in the whole entire world at that time, that both took Talmud really seriously and also took girls learning seriously, girls Jewish learning seriously. That was Yeshivat Rambam Maimonides Academy in Baltimore. Sadly, it no longer exists. Talmud and math were two of my favorite subjects, and many assume that people who love Talmud are also enamored with the logical intricacies of any other kind of analytical puzzle. If you're a math person, you'll love Talmud. If you're not, then you won't. And in those pre-cell phone era days, I would tie up our landline at night as Gemara tests approached. And I would review a passage of Talmud that was going to be on our test over and over again with different classmates, one-on-one, my friends who weren't really math people, you might say. But over 30 years of learning and teaching Talmud since then, spanning a number of different yeshiva settings, a PhD in Talmud, pursuing smicha, I've realized that there's actually something much deeper to my love of Talmud. It isn't just like an epic math puzzle. As heirs to modernity and the Enlightenment movement, we've been indoctrinated with the tension between faith and science. We assume that primary modes of religious belief are fundamentally at odds with free inquiry and critical thinking. The fault lines of contemporary society, they cut jagged lines between so-called devout believers and, on the other hand, secular skeptics. But what I find so profound about Talmud is that it is actually a devotional practice, a religious devotional practice that is centered on exercising and honing our critical thinking. It makes us more critical, makes us more skeptical in a sense. So when I tied up that landline in sixth grade, the religious devotional homework, so to speak, it wasn't to memorize a creed. Our God-given task in our coming of age as Jewish adolescents and Jewish adolescent girls or young women was to become critical thinkers. That is what it meant to come of age as a young Jewish woman. As the daughter of a skeptical mathematician and a lawyer, I couldn't really embrace religion any other way. My mother-in-law, who's here and did give me permission to say this, my mother-in-law is the first woman to ever receive a PhD in Talmud at Hebrew University, and she was inspired by this very aspect of Judaism. She tells how her shift from her Catholic upbringing in northern Wisconsin to her deep embrace of Judaism and Talmud study in particular came from the sense that in Judaism there was room for women to engage in intellectual pursuits. She so appreciated that in Judaism she could participate in a culture that places great value on thinking. And I am always struck by how this intuition of hers actually guided her to trailblaze a pathway to make that sentiment even more true, to make it possible for women to receive a PhD in Talmud at Hebrew University. To serve God does not mean I need to set aside my own mind, my own thought, blindly adopt rigidly imposed articles of faith. Religious study as embodied in Talmud is always, always about raising questions, pointing out difficulties in received traditions, and continuously honing our capacity to critique to refine tenets of belief and practice, what we should believe and how we should act in the world. So let's take one very important existential question as a starting point. Is it good that humanity exists? Is it good that we exist? You might expect a religious person to adopt a sort of simplistic response to that question. God created us. God is good. Therefore, our existence is good as long as we do what God says. But now we'll take a look at one way the Talmud approaches this question. We're in Tractate Erevin, 13a. For 2.5 years, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel argued. These said, it would be better for humanity had we not been created, rather than having been created. Noach lo la'adam shelo nivra, yoter mishenivra. And those said, it is better for humanity that we have been created. Noach lo la'adam shenivra, yoter mishelo nivra. They voted, they concluded, it would be better for humanity had we not been created. This is no simplistic or kind of rosy creationist picture echoing the first chapter of Genesis that we just read. God saw that everything was good. It is a mandate for inquiry, ongoing, years-long inquiry. Inquiry that does not shirk away from considering our worst fears. Maybe life itself doesn't make sense. Maybe our existence is more of a nightmare than a gift. And I wonder, over those 2.5 years, what evidence each side might have brought for their case, what examples of the goodness in human experience might have dragged out the debate for another month, another year, and which examples of human wrongdoing or suffering might have sealed the deal. The Talmud is terse. It leaves much to our imagination. And as we seek to fill in these details, we come up with our own reasons for each side. We are invited into our own inquiry, perhaps years-long inquiry. At the end of the day, what I think is particularly striking about this piece of Talmud is that we're left with an apparently kind of nihilist conclusion. It would have been better had we never been created, which means that we are left in the sense that our existence does not really make sense. Our lives are kind of incoherent by the time you get to the end of that debate and that resolution. So you might think that means it doesn't matter what we do. If it's better that we never existed, then maybe it's sort of a free-for-all. The incoherence of life could just lead to kind of apathy and nihilism. But no, in the very same breath that acknowledges it would be better for humanity to not exist, the Talmud also exhorts us that what we do actually matters very much. Our incoherent existence requires maximal attentiveness. You can turn back to the text. The continuation is, Achshav shenivra yefashfesh b'ma'asav v'amrela yemashmesh b'ma'asav. So a great example of two different versions of the same text. Now that we have been created, even though it would have been better had we not been created, we should examine our deeds, yefashfesh b'ma'asav. Or another version of this oral tradition that sounds quite similar, we should scrutinize our deeds, yemashmesh b'ma'asav. There's some debate about what these two verbs mean. Rashi seems to say examining our deeds is about the past. We should look at what we've done, especially if we've messed up, reflect on it, admit what we've done wrong, do teshuva. While yemashmesh, we should scrutinize our deeds, is about the future deeds when we're thinking about a particular action to take. If it's a good deed, we should think about any loss against the future gain. If it's a bad deed or transgression, we have to think about the current gain based on the future loss. But the point is, it's about the future. Okay, but either way, but the final conclusion of this extremely intense debate is that the only pathway forward in our incoherent existence requires our ongoing inquiry, attentiveness, and responsibility. This is all about examining and scrutinizing our actions so that we can act better, even if we know it's ultimately not going to be as good as had we never been here. So maybe our lack of faith in humanity is well-grounded, but the Talmud teaches us nonetheless to believe in human capacity for reflection and improvement. That is the only way forward. And from when I was first invited into the Talmud's conversation, I have felt that this is exactly what Talmud does best, not just a fun math puzzle. It helps us examine and scrutinize, not just the fun math puzzle, but as a call to a challenge that is sometimes joyful, but can sometimes seem impossible or even terrifying at times. The Talmud develops our capacity to carefully evaluate, to critique, and then hopefully to reimagine our actions and our impact. Even as it refuses to offer some kind of rose-colored idyllic account of human existence, better had we not been created, the Talmud believes in the power of human thought and reflection, and it takes upon itself the task of teaching us to think as the bedrock of our religious lives. So my sense, and what has been powering these 30 years of pursuit, is that studying Talmud is actually an act of faith, it's an act of courage, and it's asserting that our human capacity for careful thinking is of the utmost value. So now we're going to look at a kind of different sort of text. This mandate to examine and scrutinize, it isn't only in kind of broad philosophical terms, like in the text we just saw. Our God-given capacity and our God-given challenge for careful thought, for inquiry and attentiveness, it plays out in all areas of our lives, according to the Talmud, from the most quote-unquote sacred to the most mundane kind of details. And I want to look at an example from Tractate Makot, which is the tractate that we are studying this year in our Talmud at Hadar initiative. So hopefully many of us on this Zoom call this evening are studying Tractate Makot right now. And many folks are studying the second chapter in Tractate Makot, which is all about how to approach the extremely unfortunate case of accidental murder or an accidental death. How do we draw the line between intent, freak accident, and negligence? The Talmud asks, what is the extent and what are the limits of a requirement for us to be attentive, right, to avoid negligence? How exactly do we need to be attentive? And the work of carefully thinking through this very complex question is a matter of religious value, right? This is in the Talmud, becomes a matter of religious value, how to kind of delineate ways that we need to be attentive. We're in Mishnah Makot, it's chapter 2. Mishnah 2. Here we go. If one throws a stone into the public domain and killed someone, the stone thrower goes into exile. That is the topic of this chapter. Going into exile is the consequence for someone who very unfortunately committed an act of accidental murder. Okay. So throwing a stone in public, that would lead to this consequence of exile. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says, if only from the moment that the stone left his hand, did that person who was in the public domain stick their head out and receive the blow of the stone, well, in that case, the stone thrower is exempt. They don't have to go into exile. So the Mishnah teaches essentially that you can't just go around throwing stones in public areas and claiming you had no intent to kill anyone. You have to pay attention to your actions and to the environment. This is about cultivating attentiveness in our lives. But there are limits to this mandate for attentiveness. If someone only stuck out their head right after you threw the stone, then you can't be held accountable. Maybe you did look really carefully. Maybe you were just as attentive as you could be. And the impact of your action was simply beyond your control. So in a minute, we'll turn to the Talmud. And like we said, the Talmud teaches us to think critically. We're not just going to accept the Mishnah, our religious tradition, at face value. Religious study, as embodied in Talmud, is always about raising questions, pointing out difficulties, continuously honing our capacity to critique and refine our tenets of belief and practice. So we'll see where the Talmud takes us next. As a warning, this is a passage in the Talmud that gets into some pretty technical detail and even wades into parts of the human bodily experience you might find a little gross to talk about. But nothing is off limits for the Talmud. You can raise an idea that we might have thought was taboo. Better had humanity not been created. How could we possibly say that when God is listening and we have chapter one of Genesis? You could also raise details about things that we might think are taboo, like, we'll see here, going to the bathroom, for example. Maybe that's not polite conversation, or maybe that's not fodder for religious texts. But with its focus on intricate and sometimes technical or even kind of gross details of life, over many centuries, the Talmud has really been caricatured, it's been spurned, it's been burned, and sometimes undervalued or undermined, even within the Jewish people. And I think people fail to see the Talmud for what it is or what it can be, even when it gets into its most technical or sometimes bizarre self, which is a way to stretch our imagination and hone our thinking by holding up all aspects of human life to examination and scrutiny. Mashmesh, efashfesh, examination and scrutiny towards that purpose of living with greater attentiveness and responsibility in our world and in our lives. So we'll see what the Talmud does with this Mishnah about the stone thrower. This is Makot 7a. Can continue on your source sheet. Says the Talmud, throwing a stone into the public domain, that's the quote from the Mishnah, Mezidhu, that is intentional murder. This person shouldn't get off the hook with exile. They shouldn't be called an accidental kind of manslaughterer. That's an act of intentional murder. The Talmud is pretty clearly outraged by the Mishnah. We don't just accept earlier traditions as religious doctrine. We think critically, we voice challenges. How could it be that a person is only considered an accidental murderer if they throw a stone into the public domain where there's likely to be people? This is so negligent. It should be considered intentional murder. There should really be no excuse for this kind of dangerous behavior. That is the intuition the Talmud expresses. So the sage, Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak, tries to come up with some scenario where throwing stones in public is not so grossly negligent, right? He says, "Bisoteret kotla." Well, it's a case of knocking down a wall. You're knocking down a wall, you have to throw stones. But here too, the Talmud is not happy, right? That intuition that there's negligence here, but it surfaces again. Ibaile liyune. Well, you should have looked before you threw the stone. Right here too, the Talmud is not happy. A person has to be more careful. They have to be attentive. And this is the refrain that I want us to latch onto, not only in this particular case in this passage, and not only in this tractate, but as a general manifesto that is behind the Talmud all the time, and that it offers us as a sort of motto to live by all the time. Ibaile liyune. You should have looked more carefully. Should have been more attentive before throwing a stone in a public domain, even as part of your own legitimate work. You have to be thoughtful. Examine, scrutinize the situation. How do I act with care? This is what the Talmud is after. In this case, always. And you might accuse it of being hyper-analytical, but at the end of the day, if we want to show up in the world responsibly, we have to think and act really carefully. We have to examine, we have to scrutinize. Okay, but the Talmud doesn't just throw up its hands and give up on the Mishnah because quote unquote tradition is at odds with its own moral sensibility that this is gross negligence. There must be some case of throwing stones in public that is not so negligent. So now we try again. It's a case of knocking down a wall at night, balayla. Right? So maybe then you have more reason to believe that people aren't around, or you couldn't have seen as well. No, the Gemara says again, at night also you should have looked. Ibaile liyune. It is holding us to a high standard of attentiveness. So we're going to try again. Right? We have a problem. We have no way yet of understanding this inherited religious text, the Mishnah, but we feel accountable to our religious tradition and just as accountable to our own intuitions. When we have a question or a challenge on our religious tradition, we don't abandon our religious tradition, nor do we assume a posture of submission or sacrifice towards our own intuition. That is not what the Talmud does. Instead, we think harder, think more critically, think more carefully. And so the case becomes more complex. Bisoteret kotlo la'ashpa. You're knocking down your wall, but when the stones are getting thrown, you're knocking down your wall, they're going into a trash heap. Okay? Well, what kind of trash heap is it? Asks the Talmud. If it's a trash heap where the public spend time there, then posheahu, he's negligent. And if it's a trash heap where the public never spend time there, then anusu, you're under duress. This was some sort of freak accident. This was totally unforeseeable. Some public areas are used more than others, but even so, the Talmud claims that a person is either negligent or under duress based on the particular circumstances. So it gets even more specific. Again, we're not giving up. We are going to learn something from our Mishnah about throwing a stone in public domain, and we're not going to give up on our intuition, our moral intuition, that people need to be attentive and careful. So it ventures into a realm of human experience we might prefer not to talk about, but is nonetheless real. How people who might not have their own private bathroom use public domain for their bodily needs. Rav Papa said, our Mishnah, it's only necessary for a trash heap. It's generally used for people's needs at night. They go to the bathroom there at night. But it's not used in the day. But there are those who might happen to sit there in the day. It's not generally used, but it might happen. This person isn't negligent for throwing stones when they're knocking down their wall into the trash heap because it's not usually used in the day. You can't really blame them for not looking. But it's also not a sort of freak accident. They're not under duress because there are those who maybe sometimes happen to sit there. Okay, so some might really caricature this conclusion as a totally ridiculous, bizarre scenario contrived by the Talmud's wild hypothetical imagination to solve a textual problem of its own creation. But I don't think so. This is the Talmud telling us we have to be attentive to how we think about the public domain. Even parts of the public domain that may often remain sort of in the margins of proper public discourse and what we might like to think about. If you know that people use a particular trash heap at night for their bodily needs, but it's really not used this way during the day, there are some limits to whether you have to make sure to look around before throwing a stone as you take down a wall in that particular kind of public domain. It's not really an act of negligence, but it's also not really duress. So this is the case where the Talmud recognizes, even though it wasn't an act of murder, neither can the person simply kind of leave this event behind as some strange fluke. In fact, this person may not be able to let go of some sense of guilt. They need the structure of the city of refuge, whether as a kind of punishment or as perhaps some kind of rehabilitation. Now, we may never experience this exact case of taking down a wall and throwing stones into a trash heap that's used at night, but only very rarely during the day. We might not encounter that exact case ourselves, but we've thought through the subtleties of paradigms that teach us how to take seriously the imperative to be attentive and try to place some realistic limits around that. Okay, I do want to look at one other example. There is actually a bit of a limit on thinking carefully or being attentive, where we're going to see a little bit of a punchline here that is actually, well, one thing you have to factor in as you're trying to be attentive in your own action is that sometimes people in general are not so attentive. So we'll just look at this really briefly as a bit of an exercise in contrast. One who left their jug, we're in Bava Kamma here, Bava Kamma chapter 3, first Mishnah. One who left their jug in the public domain. So you have a jug owner, they left their jug in the public domain. Someone else came, tripped on it, and broke it. That person who broke it is exempt from having to pay for the damaged jug. That's part one. If they were injured by it, the jug owner is liable for the injury. Okay, so the jug owner is not compensated, and the jug owner is on the hook for paying for the injury that they caused. Now, what does the Talmud do with this? Right, again, Talmud, right, our sages, our later sages inheriting the Mishnah, they don't just take it at face value, raise questions. Why are they exempt, says the Talmud? They should examine the road while walking. Okay, so I brought this because you have the same phrase, the idea that a person should look, should be attentive, should be careful. That person who's walking down the road, they should look where they're going and not knock over a jug. Okay, so here we can see that the Talmud is again putting a high standard on expectations of attentiveness. And we're going to have a whole bunch of different answers to this question, which is another thing the Talmud does. Gathers multiple opinions, which seems so basic. And we all know the Talmud does this. But I want to say, in a world of sometimes things like Facebook echo chambers, just this intuition to want to gather so many different positions and views is in and of itself, I think, something that we can all learn from. The school of Rav said in the name of Rav, well, it was a case where the entire public domain was filled with barrels. The whole road was covered in jugs. So, you know, how can you expect somebody to walk around without knocking one down? It's not their fault. They should be able to walk. It's not that they were being negligent by not looking where they were going. They just didn't have a choice, so they knocked one down. Shmuel says it's taught about the dark, okay? This jug was left on the road at nighttime. So what, a person's going to notice a jug while they're walking? No. So they're not liable. Rabbi Yochanan, similar concept. It's taught about a corner. Person left their jug right where someone turns the corner, so they couldn't see it. Their eyes are not looking exactly where the jug is. Okay, but then we get to Rav Ashi's answer, right, a much later sage, who brings a tradition that Rabbi Ula had, who was in the land of Israel. They are exempt because the typical manner of people is not to pay attention to the roads. Here we have a different phrase. It's in the Hebrew, not in Aramaic. Darkan shel bnei adam, in darkan lehitbonen, en lehitbonen badrachim. They're not really concentrating so much on the roads when they're walking. That is an unrealistic expectation about attentiveness. And so if you own a jug, then one thing you have to be careful and attentive to is whether other people are attentive. We might actually be living in a world or finding ourselves in all sorts of situations where other people are not attentive. And so that is something that you might have to do. And I think this is so powerful because if the general message I'm offering is the Talmud is giving us a challenge to try to examine and scrutinize and be attentive, one thing we have to know is that we are often living in a world where other people are not attentive. And that doesn't mean you don't have to be either. Sometimes that means you have to be even more, right? That's just part of the accounting you have to do for your own attentiveness, is knowing whether other people will be attentive. So I want to take us to one final text here, which is going to be a little bit of a different turn. All of this is kind of focused on critical inquiry, attentiveness, critical thinking, challenging. There was some here about intuition, moral intuition, how that interacts with the text. But I want to suggest that the Talmud's commitment to critical inquiry and attentiveness, it's maybe most evident in the Talmud's capacity to self-critique, to examine and scrutinize even the act of study, the way we study, and to pay attention to how the way we study affects people who might be beyond the view of that close, you know, whatever circle one is in when they're in the act of study. And I want to bring here a story that is perhaps one of the more well-known stories in the Talmud. It's Ketubot 62b. It's the story of Rav Rechume. And I think it's an amazing example of this examine and scrutinize The rabbis are willing to do that even around the act of study itself. So here's our story, and I think this also brings us to some of the pathos, to emotion, right? The way that this training that I'm suggesting the Talmud is all about, training us in examination and scrutiny, should always lead to greater sensitivity and greater empathy, which is not what people always say or think about the Talmud. Okay, so here's our story. It's a good Talmudic story. It's nice and terse, and I will just mention here a thank you to Dr. Jeffrey Rubenstein, who is my PhD advisor and studies Talmudic stories, and I learned much from him about Talmudic stories. We have that story of Rav Rechume, who was always studying with Rava, his teacher, in the city of Mechoza. He would come home once a year, every eve of Yom Kippur. And we're on page 4 of your source sheet, by the way. But one day, which is the day, meaning one Yom Kippur Eve, his studies drew him in. Hava Mesachya Debetu, and his wife was anticipating him. She was expectant. Hashta ate, here it sort of has a rhythm. Hashta ate. Now he's coming. Now he's coming. Lo ata. He did not come. Kalashdata achet dimata meina. She became distressed. Her mind was distressed, and a tear fell from her eye. Havayatev ba'igra, afchet igra metute venach nafshe. And he, her husband, Rav Rechume, he was sitting on a roof. The roof collapsed under him, and he died. And that's the end of this drama. This is not dry law, as the Talmud is sometimes caricatured as. It's terse, it's a dramatic story, and it comes as one tragic piece of evidence in an ongoing back and forth about whether a sage may leave home to study for multiple years without their spouse's permission. And the narrator does not idealize a sage who solely devotes himself to sacred study. It's not exemplary. It's actually catastrophic. So in some ways, right, this is the epitome of what it looks like when authorities in power, right, the sages who hold the intellectual power, are embracing self-critique, making sure to notice dangerous outcomes of a kind of totalizing approach. You might think that a sage who gets so drawn into his studies is some sort of ideal. No, but this story is pushing back on that kind of totalizing approach. And it's telling stories that are open to really rich interpretation rather than rigidly asserting a kind of ideological orthodoxy about, you know, the supremacy of a certain kind of getting wrapped up in a religious doctrine. So that, I think, is an extremely powerful element of this story and how Talmud thinks and how Talmud thinks even about itself, which is that voice of critique and of self-critique has to always be there. It's a religious tradition that is not about a kind of totalizing approach, right? But I also think what you see in this story and what I want us to take from this story, it is many people assume that Talmud is not for them, that Talmud doesn't see them. It's somebody else's thing to love and spend time on, right? And actually, what I want to suggest, sort of ironic, is that we can sort of read this story perhaps against the grain and take it as an invitation to make sure that the way we study Talmud is a way that actually does build attentiveness, build sensitivity towards those who might even be kind of in theory beyond view of the intellectual world of the Talmud. Right? It is there to always, always expand our attentiveness, even beyond the boundaries of who you might think should enter the study house. So I would say it's our job to take up Talmud's invitation, to delve into its course of critical inquiry with passion, and to apply this critical inquiry so that we can be more attentive to our lives, to our world, and to critically reflect on whether the way we study is achieving what it should, a more responsible and a more empathic existence. It's so much in our world now is attacking the value of human thought, whether explicitly or implicitly. We have a sort of rise of authoritarianism that depends on quashing human thought. We have an attack on truth. The rise of AI in some ways suggests that non-humans might do a better job at thinking than we do. And maybe in certain realms that's true, but just the fact of how much is being invested in non-human thought can make us doubt the value of human thought. And in a way that feels so necessary in our moment, and probably always, the study of Talmud, it's the opposite of any kind of fundamentalism. Judaism, it's not about telling you exactly what to think or what to do. It's about embracing a multiplicity of diverging perspectives, seeking out a multiplicity of diverging perspectives, teaching us how to think critically, how to think carefully, and how to think more empathically. That is the fundamental of religious life, with the Talmud as the bedrock of our religious tradition. And here are four things that Talmud does that we need so badly. Right, number one, if you're just learning a sugya, Talmud takes stock and appreciates different perspectives. It's one of the first things a sugya is going to do. Take stock, appreciate different perspectives. What do various sages across generations say about this? Why? Can we fully spell out all of the disagreements? What conceptual insights can we glean from all the sources that we have? And in a world of growing echo chambers, siloed communities, whether physical or virtual, this orientation of wanting to collect all the different voices, wanting to learn from different voices, feels especially important. People sometimes call the Talmud an anthology because it collects all these different traditions' voices. I'd say we can inherit that as a kind of mandate, have a posture of trying to collect different voices and perspectives. Number two, the Talmud pays attention to details and subtleties on the core assumption that we honor the reality of the diversity of human experience. How does this play out in a broad range of circumstances, different details, different subtleties, right? What kind of trash heap was that? When should this approach versus that approach apply? The Talmud cares about all of this, cares about details, cares about subtlety. And in a world right now where truth can feel kind of slippery and the importance of facts is being debated and academic inquiry is also being undermined to an extent, right? This insistence on careful observation also has a lot to teach us. So number one, take stock and appreciate different perspectives. Number two, pay attention to details and subtleties. Number three, generations of Talmud interpreters continue the ongoing process of critique and creativity. I saw that comment at some point in the chat was like, well, what does it mean for us to take up this critical thinking? Do our opinions even matter, right? But the generations of Talmud interpreters take on and continue this process of critique and creativity that the Talmud sets us up to do, right? How do we synthesize the arguments on the particular page of Talmud into practice? How do we inherit what can be very incoherent in a page of Talmud? It has so many different ideas going on. How do we inherit that? How do we deal with unresolved questions, lingering contradictions, gaps, silences, as we try to embody our religious ideals in concrete day-to-day living? That is the job of Talmud interpreters, inheritors to this day, right? And so often, even a later commentary from 19th century will start their commentary on the Talmud and raise a challenge. Say, this didn't make sense in the Sugya. Here's some kind of contradiction. Where does that take me? How can I resolve that? And what is the insight I can glean by trying to sit with that contradiction or challenge? Okay, and number four, bringing it home, the Talmud is personal, right? What insights are most resonant in my own life and moment? What's missing from this discussion? How can I account for these gaps by building off of the language and insight discovered through deep textual excavation? This is a sort of four-step process that I invite folks who are jumping into our Talmud at Hadar this year to go on. Right, number one, take stock of different perspectives, right? See how the Talmud collects all these different perspectives. Number two, notice how the Talmud pays attention to details and subtleties. Number three, appreciate the way that generations of Talmud interpreters continue this ongoing process of critique, creativity. And number four, bring it home. What does this all mean? What's most resonant in my own life and moment? What might feel like it's missing? What can I learn from filling in those gaps? So with Talmud as the bedrock of your faith, you aren't left off the hook imbibing some kind of rigid set of beliefs or even a systematic set of values that's fantasized by AI programmers, right? There's not some rigid set of beliefs or values to work with. Talmud puts you and your mind in the driver's seat to notice, to navigate complexity, to be attentive, and to navigate complexity. You'll argue one side full-throatedly, suddenly swerve to an entirely different point of view. You'll throw up your hands in exasperation when the argument has no conclusion. You might weep at an unresolved, tragic, and cryptic story where a rabbi dies because his wife shed a tear. You might laugh at a ridiculous detail in a contrived scenario. And the fullness of this experience in learning Talmud is about inhabiting all of the dimensions of our humanity, the full range of our capacity for emotion and thought, as part of building our relationship with Judaism, part of building our relationship with God, learning how to act better in our world. Through Talmud, we have a kind of privilege of drawing on a deep well of wisdom that can touch every aspect of our own life experience, the profound, the mundane, from multiple perspectives, inviting us to refine our thinking and our actions as our authentic, complex selves. With Talmud as the bedrock of my faith, I take two things for granted. Number one, the messiness of our world and human experience is at its core incoherent. That's where we started. Better had humanity not been created. We don't have a religious tradition that's going to pretend there's some simple rose-colored explanation of the world. The messiness of our world and human experience, it's all very real. It's incoherent. But number two, in this messy, incoherent world, it is our responsibility to leap into this mess with inquiry and attentiveness. As an act of devotion and passion, we have to point out what is wrong at every turn, just like the Talmud does. What's wrong in our world? What's wrong in our religious traditions that shape our approach to our world? Both at the same time, always with an eye towards gleaning deeper insight so we can show up better in all that each of our lives demands from us. God doesn't ask for faith that is about submissiveness and obedience, like I learned when I was 12. Coming of age as a young Jewish woman meant becoming a critical thinker. With Talmud as the bedrock of our faith, we know how deeply God wants us to learn to fully develop our own thinking, to fully express ourselves. For it is only through the depth of our critique, the depth of our imagination, and the depth of our pathos that we have any hope of achieving that most delicate and powerful possibility of faith. Faith in God, and perhaps more importantly, faith in humanity. Thank you for tuning in. And I really hope this is the beginning of a journey of learning with Hadar this fall and beyond.